Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Barely Backcountry Podcast. Today's guest is Nathan Endicott, who is, as you might recognize that last name, the son of Wayne Endicott, the owner of the Bow Rack up in Springfield, Oregon. But Nathan's doing his own thing right now. He's got that Endicott Films thing going on, so we have a good conversation about that and the whole filmmaking process and what he's doing there. We talk a lot about hunting, how he got into hunting, some of his early childhood memories, talk a lot about blacktail hunting up there in Oregon, and then some good conversations about hunting down in Arizona as well. So I hope you guys enjoyed this podcast, a little bit longer one than we usually do, but the whole thing is entertaining. At least it was for me talking with Nathan, so I had a good time there. But before I get you guys into that, make sure you guys check out the podcast on Instagram. It's barely_backcountry_podcast. And then my personal is c.dillashaw. Again, make sure you guys give the podcast a like, a share, a follow, all those good things. But I will get you guys into this podcast with Nathan Endicott. All right, guys. Welcome back to another episode of the Barely Backcountry Podcast. Today's guest is a hunter, and he's a filmmaker and all that fun stuff. But today's guest is Nathan Endicott. So, Nathan, how you doing, buddy?
Doing well. Thanks, Caleb.
No problem at all. So real quick, before we get into stuff, just kind of introduce yourself, tell people a little bit about who you are and what you do, and then we can get into some stuff.
Yeah. So introduction, I am 35 years old. I'm from Springfield, Oregon. I've grown up bow hunting and doing everything outdoors here in Oregon. My dad owns an archery shop called the Bow Rack. That's also in Springfield, Oregon. So a lot of my childhood was being trailing my dad and just about every hunting adventure he would go on. And I was obsessed, I mean, from the beginning. So I also have that background where growing up in the archery shop, I've seen a lot of different characters come through. I've seen the different technology with archery. I've shot every single bow just about out there. And some were some dinosaurs back in the day, and then kind of have evolved with archery over time and getting better, sharpening my skills as a hunter. I went to school for civil engineering, and I graduated back in 2011 from Portland State University. I was recruited there to run, so I'm a distance runner at heart, and also just an athlete in kind of all the different sports that I played throughout high school, and mostly just focused on distance running and did that for 5 years in college. Once I was done with school, came back to Springfield, Oregon, where I wanted to live, got a job at a local water utility. I've been there for just over 10 years. Time's going fast. And I have a wife and three beautiful kids, another on the way. So we are a growing family. And hopefully this will be our last. Kids are just such a joy, but they're also a big commitment, a lot of work. So that's the brief background about myself.
Nice, nice. Well, tell me, I mean, obviously, for those of you that are listening that don't recognize the last name, Wayne Endicott is the owner of the Bow Rack. So I'm sure that you were into hunting at an early age. So what are kind of those like first memories you have of things like that?
Wow. Yeah. First memories. Oh, geez. I mean, my dad, he would drag me into the craziest places. We, from the Steens Mountains, I remember driving up there at high altitude. It's, I think it's up at the 8,000, 9,000 feet altitude in the Steens, and driving all night, get to a spot, and I just look like I'm in rough shape. And even so, 12 years old was the first year that I could legally hunt in Oregon back at that time. And the Steens come to mind for sure. And so we would ride motorcycles in to one of the hunting spots, and I would just be caked in dirt. I have old footage where it just looks like, you know, I'm a different skin color, much darker tone. and I had no idea. I was just doing what I was told to do, ride this motorcycle behind all the vehicles and get back into camp. And we'd use those to putt around on. So that was for elk and deer in the Steens. And then my dad put me in for youth hunts up in the northeast corner of the state. That's where we have a lot of our controlled hunt opportunities for spring bear. And as a 12-year-old, I was out there with my bow trying to kill a bear. And I didn't get it done when I was 12, but when I was 13, I killed my first bear with a bow, and actually have that hunt all on film. My dad videoed the shot, and I haven't done anything with it. It's kind of fun to watch that footage. And it's just so old. We used old cameras that videoed to high eight tapes, They're like, they look like a cassette tape, and they hold about 60 minutes, I think, of film. And they're just kind of lower quality, but it's so fun to look back on those. And those kind of come to mind as being the first. Obviously, before that, I was probably 8 years old, and I'd go up in the blacktail country with my dad. And if a buck ran across the road and he had me as just a little guy, I think he would actually pull over at times and bail out and chase the buck. There was actually one time where he killed the buck, and he actually took me and my sister back home, came back and recovered it. And there's like this picture of me wearing like a Snoopy sweatshirt on the back porch with him and his buck that he went and got back that night. It's pretty funny, but yeah, I know I've just grown up in the culture of hunting, and now that I'm an adult, there's no words to express how much I'm grateful for that. It's pretty fortunate. Not everybody gets to grow up with a dad that bow hunts, and especially one that owns an archery shop. So that's a privilege. I'm fortunate for that.
Definitely. Do you remember at all what your like first archery setup was as a kid? Like what kind of bow it was and what was all going on with it back then?
So the first bow, I believe the first bow I ever shot, besides being maybe like a small recurve, the first wheeled bow was a cabled camouflage bow, and I still have it. It's a cabled system with little wheels, and I was shooting arrows, losing them, making my own arrows, and just flinging it at everything that walked. And I was a little guy. I mean, 6, 7, 8 years old, kind of in that range. I think right around 8, I imagine. I don't know any of the ages, for certain, but my dad got me a green PSC, and it was my first legitimate compound bow, and it was a wheeled bow. I think they would call them like it wasn't even it, I don't even know if it technically would classify as a dual cam, but yeah, it matched top and bottom for the wheels, and it was all like shiny chrome green. It was super cool bow, and my sight was a wire. It was a wired sight, so I think we would dab some white out or color a paint on each wire crossing. So you would basically early, like the earliest days of what would be now of like a fiber optic pin, but just like a flow yellow or flow orange, and we'd dab it on the crosshairs of that sight. And I was decent as that little. I mean, I shot in the bow rack like as much as I could. I was getting pretty good at 20 yards as a kid. And then from there, eventually I got a PSE Spider. So when I was 12 years old, I had the PSE Spider, and I killed my first bear with that. And then I broke my arm, and I switched over to, I want to say, a PSE Nova. And then I had to shoot that bow left-handed because I broke my left arm. And so I couldn't straighten my left arm. And then from the Nova, I went to a PSE Carrera. And so I shot PSEs. PSE was such a, I mean, that bow company was one of the first that really developed a really good compound bow. There was many out there. Martin was another. I think Matthews for sure, and Hoyt were on the scene, but mostly for an adult bow, not necessarily a youth bow. And so starting off, it was all about shooting the PSE bows, and I shot them well for a young guy with a bow hunter setup, and yeah.
Nice. Are there any other hunts as you were going up and, through your teenage years and all that, that really stand out to you as some really good memories or anything like that?
Growing up, and then my favorite or a memory that would really stand out.
Yeah. Is there like a certain hunt that like really stands out to you throughout your teenage years and all that, as you were going up?
My first elk. So I killed my first elk with a bow. Quick backstory. I had not shot a rifle at all. Can't even, I think I shot a rifle for the first time when I was maybe like 25, 26 years old. It was an old 30-06 I bought. So when it comes to hunting, the rifle was like the last thing that my dad would ever have put across, for me to use. It was always about a bow. And with that said, there's countless times where, you know, I was a decent shot, but when you're a little guy, 12, 13, 14 years old, and you're just trailing your dad, and then all of a sudden it's like, hey, shoot this animal. It was very hard. And with the equipment back then and the speed of those bows, like, it was such a long shot, no pun intended, you know, to kill anything.
Yeah.
I got it done, and I was killing a deer every year, and I got a couple bears with my bows, but an elk was just such a big animal. I had countless opportunities. One time it was in the Steens, and it was a 45 yard shot. It's like a chip shot, but for me, that was like my bottom pin. It was a 40 yard pin. And so I think I remember aiming high, and I hit really low, and it just skipped off the brisket of a bull. And so that was definitely a very challenging way to be introduced to hunting, was through archery only with really old equipment. So my success didn't really happen until bows got better, to be honest, and until I could pull maybe more weight and shoot a faster speed. And so that said, my first bull, I was going into freshman year of high school. It was 2 days before freshman year of high school. And so that would have been like, what is it? Is that 15 years old?
Somewhere around there, I think.
Somewhere around there. Yeah, but that's the age, right? And my dad and I, we hiked into the Willamette National Forest, and it was an area that was a wilderness area. We hiked back in. Oh, it's about 2.5 to 3 miles. We crossed a river over an old growth log, and then we ascended about 1,500 feet up through some lava rocks and really this nasty craggy ridge. And we break over the top, and it's a big flat bench that's about 1.5 mile by 3 miles long. And I know this area very well now as an adult. So we get to the top of this flat, and I had not really ever experienced really good elk calling. And areas like this in Oregon, where there is zero hunting pressure, because I could promise you, I know everybody that's killed an elk up there.
Yeah.
So it gets no hunting pressure. And when we hit that flat and my dad lets off a bugle, immediately we have a response, and it sounded a long ways off. And so my dad, you know, let's move a little bit, bugles again. This bull has cut the distance on us, and we only had moved about 50 or 60 yards, and it's coming. So my dad sends me forward about 10 feet, and he jumps back and he starts cow calling. And this bull, we have film of it actually. And we could see it walking through the trees, and I could tell it was a bull I wanted to shoot. And he never committed. And so he left. So we do this same repetitive, follow the bull to the next little bench. And it was kind of carved out as if it was an old lake bed. So with these little benches, we'd climb up through a rocky cliffy section, hit a little bench and call. This bull would come in again to about 50, 60 yards. And I can't shoot that far at that time, you know, effectively. And then that bull would lose interest, circle back. And I believe he had some cows that he would tend to. And then so by our last setup, it was about the fourth or fifth setup, my dad says, okay, Nathan, you got to go out way in front. Let's say 50, 60 yards. You got to get out there where you can't quite see me. So my dad hangs back. I go forward. This is our last really, you know, attempt. Dad bugles. Here comes this bull flying in. It races right by me at about 30 yards, and I had no shot opportunity. And the thing just goes straight to my dad and stops about 10 feet out behind a tree that kind of makes a V shape. And it just hits the brakes, looks right at my dad, and then whirls around. And when he's running out, I, for some reason, just had it in my head. I knew how to stop an elk, and I go, whoo! And I just make this like deep barrel sound with my high pitched voice at that time, and stop that bull, rip back my bow. I just am like, that's 45 yards, just complete estimate, shot and nail it, quartering away. The bull ran maybe 100 yards, piles up. And I recall my dad saying something to me. He goes, I wish so badly that your grandpa Endicott could be here to see you kill this bull. And so that phrase stuck with me for my whole life, still to this date. And a lot of my hunting, I always think about, you know, I wonder if grandpa, what it was like when he hunted it back in that time, because my grandpa covered a lot of the same areas. And I always thought about what kind of experiences he had. Did he ever think about, you know, his grandkids being up there, things like that. So that's my favorite memory. One of my favorites. It was my first elk. My dad called it in and I got to be with him on that. So
yeah, I would say there aren't very many people that get to have a memory like that. So that's something special for sure.
Yeah, I was really fortunate.
Awesome, man.
But that, okay, I guess the last thing to say about that is, well, I described the hike in. So my dad and I, we piggybacked those quarters from that bowl until it got pitch black dark. And it was probably 10 p.m. because during the summer, it gets dark really late. And I think we probably quit it around 10 p.m. And we were halfway down that lava rock, nasty 1,500 foot climb. And we just dropped all the meat there and we carried what we could. And we got out as fast as we could back to the truck. I think we get back to the truck around midnight, maybe a little bit after. We drive back into town and we sleep for 2 hours and then 2 to 3 hours, like took a nap. And yeah. Then we go by, my dad never gets fast food. And I swear we stopped at Jack in the Box because it was 24 hour.
Yeah.
And my dad just gets me some food and we drive right back in there, hike back in. And then we do a one tripper with pack frames. Cause back in that time too, we didn't necessarily hunt with pack frames. We had day packs and that's what I had. And it was like a neoprene strap. Like you couldn't put more than 40, 50 pounds in there without that thing coming apart. So we hike back in with pack frames and we pack the rest of that bull out. And I mean, those Roosevelts are giant bodied bulls and it was a 5x5 bull. It was a beautiful bull and it was not small. And so we came back in there and did a one trip out and that was very brutal. But going in as a freshman in high school, my dad was having me squat like reps of, 200 pounds. And so I was a fit young kid and we were able to get that bull out, but it also ended with while it was like one of the high moments of my life at that point, I definitely had to work for it. That was not an easy come easy go bull.
Yeah. But I mean, that's probably what looking back on it makes that memory so special to you. Like a lot of people talk about it in hunting, like that type two fun, the stuff that sucks while you do it. And then you look back on it, as soon as you get to the trailhead and you're driving home, you're thinking about how much fun that was.
You're right. Who says that? Was that like a Rinella quote? Like who?
I think Rinella was one of the first guys to bring it up on the Joe Rogan podcast.
Yeah, I heard that. Like if it was Rinella, that's the first time I heard it. Yeah, that's cool. That's a good quote. I do identify with that statement.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, those are some of the best memories are those the things that suck while you do it. But
yeah.
So tell me a little bit about the hunting season that just wrapped up. I saw you came down to Arizona and then your dad had a bighorn sheep tag. So tell me a little bit about what happened this year for you or last year, I guess.
Yeah. So my season started with the over-the-counter archery elk hunt in Oregon. Recently that changed from being both a west side and east side over-the-counter opportunity to now we have more controlled hunts in the northeast portion of Oregon. So we have a much more limited, true over-the-counter archery hunt. And I hunted the Coast Range to do something a little different. I don't typically hunt the Coast Range. And I got a bull on the holiday weekend. I had some buddies come in and help me pack it out. I was kind of struggling at the start of this season. I underwent a lot of different health issues. One of them was a knee surgery, had a back injury, and just not fun stuff to go through. And it all happened at one time. So actually my whole beginning of the year, everything from February 1st to September was just purely based on like recovering, getting ready for archery season, trying to get back at it. So I got that bull. I bugled it in, just stopped to eat lunch, cut out a bugle, heard something behind me, didn't see what it was, come sneaking around the corner, it's a bull, draw back 55 yards, pin in, touch off, and he just ran 30 or 40 yards. So that was the kickoff really to my season. I wasn't even sure if I was going to be able to hunt. So that, and then from there, next up was my stepmom had a New Mexico elk tag. And I got to meet some really neat people. Kip Folk from previously, one of the founders of Under Armour.
Yep.
And And then kind of his crew. So I was there in New Mexico, filmed a hunt for my stepmom. That's on YouTube. You can watch it. My dad was there calling for us. And after that, what did I do? I think next would have been, was it Idaho? Or was it my dad's sheep hunt? I think it was, oh, darn it. Yeah, I can't remember on the timeline perfectly, but my dad drew a sheep tag, a California bighorn sheep tag in Oregon. The draw odds were 0.28%.
Nice.
And he'd been applying for over 45 years, and he finally drew. It's one of those things where we always joke, it's no, I shouldn't say that, but ODFW, the way they allocate tags, it doesn't always seem to like align with people that put in for 45 years. It seems like, you know, it's a tag that's kind of almost always going to like a first year hunter or a lady. And it's like, how does that work out every single year? And even on my dad's hunt, there was a gal that had drawn it. And you got to think the odds then for a woman to draw being as a percentage of the total applicant pool. I mean, maybe there's 10% are female, and then just so to see a female draw out of the, you know, 100% pool of applicants, it's pretty low odds. And, but that seems to be the case. I don't know. Our draw system is all completely random. So my dad did pull the tag. He had put in for basically a lifetime. And it was one of his dream hunts, was to hunt sheep in Oregon. And so I was able to video that. That film is now in the Full Draw Film Tour. You could watch it at any of the tour locations. You go on the website, drill down to tour locations, and you could buy a ticket. We have a showing at the Endicott Farms on May 13th at 7 p.m. And there's 300 tickets available. So I think they're going pretty quick. To be honest, they will sell out. And we have a mini 3D shoot and a food truck, different things to kind of occupy the earlier part of the day. So that was my dad's sheep hunt. And then I was feeling well enough to go on an Idaho mule deer hunt. I'd purchased an over-the-counter deer tag and was going to return it because there was no way I was going to hunt. But I found out that I would only get like 10% of my money back. And I was like, heck, I'll just keep the tag. Maybe I'll be able to go. So I did. I went. And I hunted for a couple days and ended up getting a mule deer buck with a rifle. And I've probably shot a rifle less than 50 times in my whole life, just to be honest. And that was my second deer with a rifle to date. So I have a film of that one on the YouTube channel. People could check that out and see that hunt. And that pack out was pretty brutal. It was around 2,500 feet descent, 6 miles. One way, and had to cross a river. And you don't really know that from the film, but it was a big effort. And coming off of the knee surgery and the back injury, I just basically used trekking poles and took as many breaks as I needed. And but that was a solo effort. And it felt really good. Let me tell you, like, to be at one point in my life where I'm laying in bed thinking, like, can I ever get back to doing what I love to do? I want to hunt by myself and pack out animals. To then being doing that, right, like 5 to 6 months after, I was very happy. That's like an understatement. You know, like it meant, it meant a lot to be able to do things on my own again. So from there, what was next? It's all kind of blurring together. So, okay, from there, it was my over-the-counter late season archery blacktail tag. And that's a hunt I've been doing for a lot of years. I probably could fill like 8 hours worth of talking if I just went from day one to now. So I think I have a spreadsheet that tracks how many times I've gone into a particular area, and it's over 250. So of days where I've been in this particular area. So I just have a plethora of knowledge. Like I could walk these areas in the dark, and we're talking like 6 miles in and rugged terrain. It feels so comfortable and natural to be in there. So I ended up hunting really hard, holding out for a mature buck. And on 3 days left with season, it was like a Hail Mary effort. I had this buck I'd already videoed. It's a beautiful buck, and he's not a big scoring buck, but really cool frame, fork by four, tons of mass, carries his mass all the way out to the ends of his tines, bladed eye guards, really tall, framey buck, beautiful double white throat patch with more of that reddish sandy colored hide to him. And so he steps out at 70 yards. It was just snowing so freaking hard. I couldn't get a range on him, and I'm hitting the range finder. Couldn't get a range. I tried for like 5 minutes and finally just kind of gave up. And he was standing below me broadside, not doing anything. And I always make deals with myself. The deal is always, you know, if I can get a range on him, if he's not looking, if he's looking away, you know, and I could probably take that shot depending on its distance, right? Like if I feel like it's a little bit longer shot. So this buck just kept standing there, and there was some deer below him, some deer that I was stalking. So he was kind of preoccupied. He was looking down the hill at a doe and a buck that had been bedded down there, but it's still just pouring snow. Well, a breeze picked up at just enough to be able to wipe out some fog and some snow, pulled up my binos, range him 70 yards on the money. I have an option sight. So I was able, are you familiar with that? You are. You're familiar with that. Yeah.
Yep.
So dial that mover pin right down on 70. I practice out to 90 just to make sure that I'm good on release and I know how to execute a shot. Doesn't matter if it's 20 yards or 90 yards. 70 is definitely in my comfort zone. Pin in, touch off, smacked him, and he runs down and piles up in sight. So that was like, it was literally like the emotion you get when you throw the Hail Mary touchdown pass. It's caught barely and it hits the upright, or you like dive into the end zone and barely get the touchdown. So that's what it felt like. I was overwhelmed again, not knowing if I'd even do that hunt this year, the whole year thinking about that, like, can I get back? Can I do it? Sure enough, I did it. It's steep, nasty terrain. You're climbing, you're exhausting your body. There was, you know, a couple inches of snow and got that buck out by myself. So
nice.
A couple things. We're not even done yet.
Oh, hold on. Wait, what do we got? We got, after that, where'd you go?
No, Arizona. I'll just make it short and sweet. I went to Arizona. I got a buck. And then it's a really old, ancient deer, missing some teeth. And then my wife and kids came down, and we spent the holiday down there together. I'm going to make a film on that one. And so folks can watch that, see that experience here sometime soon. But yeah, hopefully you like really long answered questions.
No, I love it. I mean, we could listen, talk hunting stories all day.
Right.
Love doing that. But going back to the blacktail thing. So you said you had like about 250 days logged in this one place.
Yeah.
How many out of those 250 days, how many bucks have you killed in that spot on average, you think?
Oh, and when I say spot, I mean an area that's probably like 40 miles by 20 miles. Like it's a range. It's a mountain range. And then you want to know how many bucks in that spot?
Yeah. Just on average, like, out of those 250 days, like, what's your success rate, you know, compared to the amount of work that you're putting in? Like, how successful are you?
Okay, so that number corresponds to including, like, spring hiking into high lakes, because I do a lot of fishing on float tube.
Gotcha.
Shed hunting, the whole bit. So I would say my success rate typically, you know, is somewhere between 5 to 8 days of effort. I will get a buck. And then how many bucks up there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I'm counting right now. 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Almost done. I know we're almost done. 12, 13, 14. All right. 14 bucks.
Dang. You got a pretty good track record, it sounds like, then.
It's coming along. You know, I've got some time left
to
really figure things out, but.
For sure. Let's talk about like the hunting strategies that you use. Cause I see some guys will go and sit in a tree stand for blacktail. And then it sounded like you were stalking some animals. So what are you like to have that success?
Yeah. The majority of my success is on foot. I've killed, it's growing smaller every year, the number of animals that I've called in or sat in a tree stand to harvest. that number keeps getting smaller, obviously. Well, the percentage keeps getting smaller. So yeah, with blacktail, I almost exclusively just still hunt. And still hunt's kind of a misleading word. I don't like it, but that's the formal word that defines what I do. Really, what I would call it is that I have a don't quit, don't stop moving hunting method. I basically just grind my body down to nothing, where nothing's left. And usually at that point, if I've given it everything I had, I already killed a buck. Like, there's no doubt. I have no doubt in my mind that if you give me time and I have my feet and my back and everything's working right, I'm going to kill a buck. And I put in the preparation. Like, there's just nothing holding me back from doing what I love to do. And that's work really hard for what you can accomplish. And with still hunting, you can still call. So I've had some second chance opportunities with using a small doble. I use the can call. I don't tip it. I blow on it. We've talked about that in one of my films. It's a tactics film, and it's pretty effective. I've spooked a buck before. He's taken off running, and I start blowing on that thing, and I've actually had him loop back around. And that buck specifically, I shot at 40 yards. One time I shot a little fork by three way back when I was a sophomore in college, and I just blew on the can call a couple times. It was enough to get him to stop because he was cruising really fast, and he stood just for a minute below me at 45 yards. And so I have called before. It does work, but the problem with call is that the animal's alert. It's looking towards you, not away from you, and it's more likely to move, jump the string, or spook before you can get an arrow off. And I don't like that. I like my animals to have no idea anything was there and complete surprise, because they'll take an arrow. They'll take an arrow at 60 yards, 70 yards. If they have no idea you're there and there was not a lot of clue as to being alert or a predator. And even another thing is that if they don't necessarily know what it is, like say rattle, they're coming in on guard. It doesn't matter if they are sold, it's another buck or a deer, right? A rattle, they're coming in alert and ready to fight. They're maybe intimidated. Maybe they're already super scared because they don't know if it's that big buck they lost to last week. They just want to come check it out. So I don't like rattle either for that point. And it's just so much more difficult to get an arrow in a buck when he's coming in alert. And with blacktail, you can get away with a lot more in terms of shooting through a shoulder, something like that, compared to elk when you call in a bull. So guys can be pretty effective. My dad shot a buck this year by rattling it in. I rattled in the biggest buck to date that I've really seen. And it came in head on. I didn't see it until it was like 20 yards away, and it had me pegged because I had the rattle antlers in my hand, not the bow. I hunt by myself, so it's pretty tough to pull off rattling and calling and shooting an animal. I would recommend only doing that really with a dedicated caller. That's what a lot of guys would do anyways. But it is tough to hunt with others in this country. I mean, it's double the sound, double the scent, double the movement, and an animal's going to pick up on that. Another thing is that I always feel like a really smart old buck, he's probably heard a call a time or two. And is a really old buck going to come in? And what I'm targeting is a more mature animal. I don't necessarily care about inches of antler. Some guys are obsessed with, you know, hitting number marks. And for me, I want to have a good quality experience. I want to know that that animal lived a good long life, that he was able to breed, pass on his DNA, genetics, whatever, do his thing. And then I want to shoot that buck that's like 1 year out from dying on his own. Like, that to me feels the most fulfilling. That's also why I still hunt. I still hunt because I'm sure there's methods I could do, like calling, sitting in a tree stand. It just doesn't feel the same. I want to earn it. I want to work for it. I want to bleed for it. Like, I want to do everything in my power to know that there was nothing I left behind. And that's why I still hunt. I could probably be just as effective not doing that, but so far it's working out. I've been on a streak since 2011, and I plan to just kind of keep going after it.
For sure. I mean, it's like it's working. But so I'm assuming in that area of the country is too thick to do like your standard like glassing and spot and stalk type hunting, it sounds like.
Spot and stalk's pretty tough. Guys can do it, but it would be very selective. You would You would essentially go to a burn or a logged unit, and then it has to be of the right age, not overgrown. Some guys rifle hunt old burns, and they're able to sit on an opposite hillside and turn up bucks, you know, half mile off and shoot them a half mile away. I know a couple of guys that consistently do that and shoot just freak insane giant bucks, but you know, I don't know how they do it. I don't want to question the intent or the moral behind it, but that is how they do it and they get it done. Again, I'm not about just necessarily giant racks. While that's cool, I just want to be out there and feel the experience, really get close. So spot and stock, you can do it. It's harder, in my opinion, because you're kind of narrowed down to where you can hunt. And then other methods. Did you say something else besides spot and stock?
No, but I mean, if there's other methods out there that guys are using, I want to hear it.
Well, then just tree stand, sitting on a trail because it's so thick and brushy. So it's pretty effective. You can either bait, so that's one of them, or you could just sit on a major trail crossing or some terrain feature that really concentrates the deer. And then the other variable is what time of year is it? Do the deer concentrate there for a reason, like too much snow? So I guess all said, it would be, it'd be sitting. Yeah, you would sit. I don't like that. I get antsy.
Yep. Yeah. Like, I've done one tree stand hunt and I wasn't even doing all day sits, but I was going crazy sitting in a tree stand for 4 or 5 hours at a time.
So, okay. The other thing is like, probably my pet peeve is to sit, because my dad had me sit a lot as a kid when I was 12, 13, and 14. We'd go back in a wilderness area, like 5 or 6 miles, camp in a meadow somewhere. And then he would let me go in the dark and say, okay, go get in that tree stand. And so then I'd hike another 2 or 3 miles out some crazy ridge, climb up in a tree, sit there for 5 hours, freeze to death. I have a couple stories about doing that kind of stuff. And then it just wasn't for me. I got burnt out. I probably spent, you know, a few hundred hours sitting in a tree the first couple of years. And yeah, at that point, once I realized I could get it done in another way, why would I ever sit in a tree? It just feels so limiting. I named my blacktail film Fate because I felt like there was a lot of things that came together beyond my control, right? Like I would bet money against myself that outcome that I had would not have happened. Like there's no way that outcome happened. And then sure enough, it happened. So that felt like it was fate. And also I'd rather put my fate in myself, in my feet, in my senses than some tree. I don't want to put it in some tree. You know, I didn't come that far to then just go ahead and limit myself to a piece of aluminum that hangs 30 feet off the ground. Like I want to put my fate in my boots, in my feet, in my hearing, in my sight, and in my ability to shoot a bow, like a quick draw more or less. And like, be confident in who I am.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, for me, like those hunts where I go, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 days and don't get an opportunity and it's not in my hands, those are the ones that bother me.
Oh, but it wrecks you, right?
Yeah. But when you go and, you know, maybe you have 2, 3 opportunities and you know that it was 100% because of you that you didn't kill something, those I can live with.
Yes. But yeah, because you did everything you could, right? Yep. There's nothing you couldn't have done. Like you screwed up or whatever. It's like, I did everything I could. I did my best. I can live with that.
Definitely. Definitely. Well, one last thing I want to touch on before we get into the filmmaking stuff.
Okay.
So obviously your dad was a big part of getting you into the outdoors and now you have kids. How are you kind of doing that now that you're in his shoes? How are you getting your kids in the outdoors? Is that something that they're interested in as far as the hunting type stuff and all that?
Yeah. Good question. And I'm glad you asked. I think it's so important that hunters consider their children, their kids early and expose them to hunting and not just say, oh, it's something I do with my buddies, but it's something you could do with your wife, your kids. Sometimes the spouse is not into it. They have other things. That's fine, whatever. But I feel like it is a team effort if you're married, and being on the same page there is important, especially when it comes to hunting and harvesting the food that you plan to eat. But you know, hopefully that you eat it. And then, so with that said, you know, my kids right now, they're pretty young. They're 5, 3, and 1. But I've got deer mounts all over my house and in the garage. And so my son's like third word was elk. And I think I actually have that. I have it on my phone. I was videoing him and trying to get him to say it. And then sure enough, boom, he said elk. And so like from a very early age, I'm trying to introduce the animals that we eat it. I'm telling them every time at dinner, like, this is daddy's elk. Or mama, mm-hmm. hey, what'd we cook today? Was it deer or elk? And it's like, oh, this one's bear. And so I'm trying to expose them to what it's all about. And then of course I make my films. So they're not my biggest fans, but they might be in the top 10 because they've watched all my films. They had a couple lines quoted. my daughter used to quote my dad in my Kodiak film. It says like, for a Kodiak buck, he's got pretty good eye guards. And so she would say that line when she was about 3 years old, and it was the cutest thing. And so now my 5-year-old, it was three at that time, it's my daughter. She'll ask me to tell her a bedtime story every night. And she'll say like, daddy, tell me about the second bear you killed, or tell me about the time you were with mommy and you got a deer. And so sure enough, I mean, I have those stories. So I'll tell her those as bedtime stories. It's just so important to involve your kids, because they are carrying on not just your own legacy, but a hunting legacy. And we are hunters. Like, that is in the human DNA. We hunt. We collect our food through basically the best means possible. And that should nourish our bodies. It has for all of time. And I think that's so important to continue for both mental and physical development of who we are. And I feel like half my body was built on protein from elk. So, I mean, I've been eating it since a little kid. And then the last piece of that is, now as an adult, I look back and wish so badly that my grandpa had a YouTube. How cool would that be, that I could just sit down and watch grandpa hunting the same wilderness areas that I want to go now? I think about it all the time. And so my dad, I have some film. We have all the Hi-8 stuff. I burnt it to electronics so I can watch it. And I have quite a bit of film. And I could see his old buddies and where they went and how they hunted. But it's just still, it's pretty hard to watch. It's not great quality. So for me, I want to make films. The reason I started making films was so that my kids could see it. And someday, maybe go. They could know what I was all about. They could see me in my prime before I'm old and decrepit, which I'm already there. So anyway, I love that part of what I can do to hopefully encourage my kids to partake in the same activities I did as a kid. So that was kind of a long answer again to.
No, I think it's a question. A long answer though. Like you said, it is important that gets passed on. So.
Yeah, we depend on it as hunters, because I mean, who's going to fight for our hunting rights in the future? It's definitely being challenged right now. It's happening in the West. It's happening in Washington. They took away a spring bear hunt last year with no guarantees anything like that's coming back. Hunting opportunities continuing to be restricted and restricted. In Oregon, they've introduced wolves. Well, what happens when the wolves have really when the elk and deer populations take a major hit? Well, let's reduce hunting opportunity. It's the platform's there. Unfortunately, there's agendas, and I really hope that hunting opportunity is maintained, but hunting is not a right in Washington, Oregon, and California, and quite a few other states. Hunting is only a right in 22 states. I looked that up recently. So hunting is a privilege if it's not a right, and that privilege can be taken away. So that's why I feel like it's so important to teach our kids to hunt. Also, it's like, be on the same page. If you're a hunter and you're putting your content out there, don't blast other hunters, or agency officials. I saw one person post not too long ago putting an agency official on blast on their social media account. This person had 24,000 followers. And it's like, hey, while the way that you are conducting your social media, you're unfortunately at the discretion of their ability to keep hunting as an opportunity in your state. So why are you putting them on blast? Like, work with them, ask questions, find out how you can partner with them. And I always invite that. So whenever I get any comments on my feeds that are slightly controversial or hey, you just said that hunt was OTC. Now I'm going to lose all my hunting opportunity. And I respect that. I appreciate that. I feel that same pressure here in my state where you know, tons of people come from out of state to hunt because we have a lot of over-the-counter opportunity. But the reality is that I want to promote and encourage hunting. And the only way to do that is to partner and work together. So I hope you see it that way too. You know, I give the alternative. Well, the alternative is that it could be taken away. If that could be taken away, we need to work together.
Exactly. Yeah, you see it all the time on social media. It's like, it almost seems like the hunter's biggest enemy is the hunter, is another hunter. So people just can't seem to get along, it seems like. So,
yeah, competition, but, I guess.
Yep. But
I get it. I'm not, I definitely do not discredit where that person's coming from. I just want them to know the alternative and why we do this. You know, I want to be known for what I'm for, not for what I'm against.
Definitely. Definitely. Well, let's get into the filmmaking stuff. How did that start for you? Where is it gone now to where you're at now? So kind of explain that.
Yeah. My first film was a mule deer hunt in the Eagle Cap Wilderness of Oregon. And that's my episode one. It's archery over the counter mule deer. And that film is a little shaky. I videoed it with an old GoPro, and it was one of those things where it's like, I've been videoing my whole life. I've always had a video camera, even from the very earliest days. My dad would give me his hand-me-down. I videoed everything. If it was a quail in the backyard, it doesn't matter. If it moved and it was an animal, I was videoing it. So it's not new to me. And I would burn my own hunting DVDs, because growing up in the industry, I got burnt out. Like, there was nothing that was better than what I felt my dad and I would experience. So why would I want to watch these other hunting shows? I've seen them. Like, my dad would play them on repeat in the shop, and I have a couple of them memorized, like Gold Rush Bucks, Elk Fever 1, 2, and like great shows. And that was awesome. But watching somebody else hunt just wouldn't do it for me, right? So
yeah.
I created really my own hunting films, and I have some really funny stuff from back in the day, burnt to DVD. I'd use like AC/DC or some other copyrighted music and just make a film. And so I think, so my video camera that I purchased on my own was back in 2011. So from 2011 on, I have better quality film, and I just didn't do anything with it. Again, you know, I made my own hunting films, but it was 2019, and that was that mule deer hunt. I finally reached a point where I was like, why don't I just figure out how to use non-copyrighted music, royalty-free, and make a film? Like, it's possible. People do it all the time. So I went ahead and just did it, put it out there, and it gets a few views. It's a beautiful area. It's not horrible. And then I made a couple films of bear hunts. And a couple of them were my wife, and she had some really cool opportunities on bear. We called one in. It comes running in below us. That was a really cool hunt. So anyway, all of that said is that I've been improving. I've been getting better. And it turned from just making a film so that I'd have it like in a document management system like YouTube. It was basically a place to save it and share it, so I could easily share it with my family, whatever. So then I was like, well, if people are going to view it and judge it, you know, because everything you put out there that's for the public eye can be judged, will be judged. And so I'm like, I don't want to make anything that's not as good as I could make it.
Yep.
So that's where maybe it was, what year was that? I'd say for probably a year and a half, 2 years, I've been trying harder. And eventually I purchased better software. I got better cameras, got better camera lenses. Got a couple of different types of cameras to the point where now I feel like I could put together a decent film. One of them, like my dad's sheep hunt, I put a lot of hours into that. That's the most I've spent on any film. I spent over 100 hours on edits. So if you don't like it, don't tell me about it, because that one was way too much effort. Anyway, yeah, so that's where I'm at, is just continuously improving, continuously enjoying it as to the full. And for me, It's not hunting and filming are not exclusive things. Like, for me, those overlap. Hunting is filming. Hunting is sharing the experience, telling the story. I can do that with a camera in my hand and shoot an animal. You know, it's not separate. It's not, hey, let's go on a hunt and have it filmed. It's like, no, I'm going to have a camera in every hunt I've ever been on. So it's not. So when did it start? Day one. I've always been filming and wanting to share that story because, you know, a picture says 1,000 words, you know? So that's kind of where I've always been at is why would I just tell you all the nuanced details when I can show you, check this out. And that's kind of where I always have been with it.
For sure. For sure. What do you think, what goes into like telling the story of a hunt? Like, how are you making sure you convey that to the audience? Just like some advice on that for people that are looking to start filmmaking.
Yeah, I would say, so that's almost feels like that's a two part. So one part is like, what would you tell somebody that wants to get started with it? And then the other part is like, how would you tell a story? So I'll start with first, I'll start with some quick advice. My quick advice is while all film is important to you because you took it.
Yep.
So all of your work is valuable. You know, if you spent your time doing it and if you're proud of it, that's valuable. That's great. But does it belong on a hunting film? That's the question you got to ask yourself. Does it add value to the story of the hunt? So you and I are talking and I want to tell you a story. I'm not going to add in all this unnecessary filler stuff just for the heck of it. Right.
Yeah.
But it was cool. But does it add value to the story? Does it convey the message? Does it give you a full picture? If it doesn't do those basic components, don't add it. Because so often when I watch a hunting film, I see shaky film because the person left their camera on and they thought it was neat maybe to show that the whole process, right? From walking, they shot something, they put their camera down, it's shaky, they're walking all the way there. It's like, well, I can probably understand that you made it to the animal if you shot it. You don't have to show me on the film, right?
Yeah.
Are you tracking? So my best advice, if you're going to make a film, think about all the stuff that you really want to communicate. Make your film and then go through and start cutting out all the stuff that doesn't help or add value. Because when I edit, I want somebody to enjoy the film regardless if they saw the shot or not. So many people get caught up on the shot, which is very cool. I'm disappointed if I don't get to see how the action went down, but it's like almost like a guy will make a 30-minute film for a really cool, you know, 20 seconds of action. And so what will happen if you look at YouTube analytics, everybody's watching the 20 seconds, but not your 30-minute film. So I would say, just trim out all the fat. Like that's the best advice I can give anybody. Audio is very important. Shaky film, very important to try to remove that or mitigate that. There's so many things I could say. And we could do that follow up on a next question or something. But for now, I'll pause there. Go into the other half of the question about telling a story. I feel like every story has some basic components, an open, a body, and a close.
Yep.
So if I want to tell you about my blacktail season, I'm going to tell you that I wanted to hold out for a mature buck. So I set out with my bow this year and I got to see some awesome experiences. So now we're in the body. I had a buck walk in to 10 yards and I got to watch them fight and spar. This one buck grunts on film super close. Mm-hmm. I had some great encounters, almost got it done on a giant buck. And then it ended up. And so you see, I just took you through the body of the story. Now, now we're ending up. Where are we ending up? At the end, the conclusion, the wrap up. The wrap up is that it was a grind, but then everything came together. The buck walked below me. I drew back. He stopped. I was able to get a good range on him. It was a long shot. It was iffy. So that's your crux. So it's important to throw in that, like, what makes it hard? What did the main character overcome? So that's a piece that so many leave out on a good story is like, what did you actually do? Why was it hard? Why can't everybody do this? So that crux is that I had to overcome many obstacles in my own life. And then also in this difficult terrain and a longer shot. And then it all came together, made that shot happen. The buck fell down in sight. So those are the components to make a good story. You could do that through telling that story verbally, or you could do that in showing it. So there's two ways to do that story. The awesome thing about doing it with a film is that you get to add in so much more details that tell the story for you. And so I don't have to depend necessarily on my verbal skills or my storytelling myself, but by pointing a camera at my face and videoing it, because that is also kind of my own personal pet peeve, is just being a talking head on a camera. Some people do it very well. So I'll stop there, pause there. Hopefully that's not the last thing anybody ever heard me say. it's not a famous last words here. So I think one of my most respected storytellers that I see on the hunting industry is Steve Rinella. I love how that guy can tell stories. I want to watch him talk. It doesn't matter where he's at. I could watch him talk. He has animation. He's got an interesting voice. He's got the Midwestern voice. He's intelligent. He tells a good story. And I could watch that guy talk all day long. So I don't care if it's just him on a film. Now, anybody else, it's like I get bored pretty quick. And everybody's going to obviously have preferences here on who they like and can they watch him on a film. Well, that's great because you get to choose who you watch and what you invest in. And the other is Brian Call. I really like Gritty. I love Gritty. I like what he stands for. I like his beliefs. I like how he tells a story. I like his smile. There's so many things that are great about Gritty and, well, Brian Call and Ryan Lampers. I really like them. I like how they interact. So those things, I would much rather watch them talk as opposed to just seeing the action. But then everybody else, for me, it's like, I just want to see the action, man. Get me through the story. Or else I'm going to skip. And so, you know, if you want your film to not really be viewed, that would be the alternative is, you know, go ahead and include everything you want. But a lot of people are just going to skip through it. So for storytelling, for my own editing preferences, I'm going to move through as fast as possible. I'm going to show you just what you need to see in order to know what happened. And then if I do talk, I'm going to try to overlay a bunch of film so you see what I'm saying. If I said that I climbed all morning, I'm hiking in the dark, you're looking at me hiking in the dark, you know, all the way through until the end of the film. And I don't try to make my films any certain length. They're going to be as short as possible. That's the way to put it. I'm an engineer. Okay. So like we go like, honestly, you have to simplify in math. Like that's what we were taught to do is it's the simplest way to achieve something, the most cost effective way to achieve something. So that's my engineering mindset coming out too. So not take it or leave it, you know, that's just the way I do it.
For sure. No, I think there's a lot of good advice in there for people that are interested in filmmaking. One last thing before we get you out of here, let's talk a little bit about the equipment you use for filmmaking and then what people can do. I'm sure you have some pretty high end stuff in comparison to where people start, and then kind of talk about where people can start, you know, to just get started filmmaking. So what are you using? And then what do you recommend for people that are just starting?
Good question. Again, so I recommend that it doesn't matter what you have to video with anymore. It could be a phone.
Yep.
You can make an awesome film. You could with a phone. If your goals should align with the level of investment that you place in your gear and your equipment and everything you do. If your goals are just to tell a story, share it on Instagram, then don't go investing in a really high-end camera unless you have money to burn. Yep. But for the most part, the phones can film 4K, turn it on 4K mode, get slow-mos, get time lapses, do everything you can. There's free editing software. If you have a Mac, it's iMovie. You could do it on your phone, which is kind of limited, or a computer, and that has much more, you know, capability with the tools. And you can add in music. YouTube has YouTube Studio. YouTube Studio is a database full of free music, royalty free. You could take that song, you could download it to your computer, you can use it in your project, and you could use that music for free. Everything else that I'm aware of, there might be other databases out there, but for the most part, you're going to purchase that music to get a license to use it.
Okay.
And for me, I like music. You don't have to. You don't even need that. So the bare basics is like any device that can record and just make sure that's steady. And again, apply the principles in terms of editing just to show the content of the story. Tell that story if you need to. And you can overlay audio, so your voice recordings. And so that would be kind of the introductory, the bare basics, just to do something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I bet like if you did it right, you could build quite the following and just using your phone if you had a really nice phone. So kind of moving up from there in equipment, GoPros are another cost-effective camera that can get time lapses, that can get stills, that can get 4K video, and they could be hands-free. And you could also leave GoPros on a tripod while you're out hunting and you want to get a sunrise or a night lapse and get the stars. So they're really cool because they could do night lapse. And everything's automatic. It's built-in features. You can adjust the settings a little bit to make it a little bit more manual, but for the most part, all the settings are automatic, which means easy. Auto and easy are one and the same.
Yeah.
So GoPros are nice. They're a really nice tool. And then handy cams. So every manufacturer makes a handy cam, which is like a point and shoot. You just basically hit record and everything's auto focus, auto ISO, auto shutter speed. Like everything is auto. And there's some manual settings. You could do probably a manual focus. You could probably adjust the filter on those cameras, but they're relatively inexpensive, ranging from anywhere from probably $300 to $400 up to $800. And some of them are higher end. They have 4K nowadays. And those cameras do a great job. They're small. They can be small and compact. They can fit in a small pouch on your waistband around your pack and easy to get to. I always say, if it's not accessible, you're not going to get it on film. Has to be accessible. So when I hunt, I always try to rock the GoPro on my head if I think that action's going to go down soon, because I want that to be hands-free and easy. If it's already on my head, ready to go, I'll get it on film. Otherwise, I'm going to shoot that animal. I'd rather have that animal in my hands than to have got the shot on film. But moving up from there, there's DSLR and mirrorless cameras. So they have different technology in the way that they are manufactured, but they essentially do the same thing. There's some benefits to each, and mirrorless are a little nicer for video. DSLR might be a little nicer for just still photography. Gotcha. And mirrorless, I just got a really nice mirrorless camera. I love it. They do 4K video. They have higher frame rates at that quality. And the other thing is the sensor size. So when we talk about a phone, a GoPro, or a handy cam, or a mirrorless, or a DSLR, the main difference in quality comes down to sensor size. You don't really hear it that often. Sensor size is basically the picture size that it's recording to. And each megapixel, so you've heard of megapixels, right?
Yep.
So one megapixel is a million pixels. So it's not necessarily dependent on how many megapixels for a good quality image. It's the sensor size per megapixel. So when you increase your sensor size, a megapixel increases in its size. There's still the same amount of pixels, but each pixel just got bigger. So what happens is that each pixel can take in more data. So it records better light, better color, all the things that make a good image. And so going to those full frame is what they call it, from a crop frame, is huge in terms of quality. And that's where a guy can really get better with his film quality. So that's all the things about cameras. Now, the same applies with your editing software. The lower end stuff is going to be kind of limited. It's going to allow you to do just enough to share that story, to make that film. Now, as you move up, it always comes down to how much do you want to spend? You know, what's your goals? Is your goal to make a major production, something that's going to be professional, go on the Outdoor Channel, or maybe even make it in a film tour? The Western Film Festival, all those things. So you might want to invest in Adobe Premiere or Final Cut Pro, something that can do a lot more. There's add-ons, there's all sorts of editing features and filters and custom-built tools that you can use. And so where I'm at personally is I use Final Cut Pro. I use a combination of GoPro, Handycam, and mirrorless and DSLR. Like I use it all. I have cameras like literally strapped all over my body. I have like a fanny pack that has some of the quicker stuff, because for me, I just have to get every part of the story that's meaningful. And so it means a quick draw. Like I got to get the camera out. Oh, I'm not shooting. Camera's coming out. And I've got to be fast or else the opportunity passes, the animal moves, the thing's no longer there, the lighting changes, whatever. So I compile all that footage and whittle it down until I have a project that I'm happy with. And I don't spend a ton of time on my films. I make them where I'm happy. I get to the point where, you know, it's not work for me. It's fun. So I get to a point where I'm happy with it. It's like, I did what I could. I like it. I can make it better if I tweak at it for another 15 hours, but for the most part, I'm happy with it. So that's when I hit the go button and I just go ahead and burn it or export it and then share it. And so that's kind of where I'm at.
Gotcha.
Does that answer what you're looking for?
Absolutely. For sure. Cool. For sure. Is there anything else you want to touch on? Any, you know, important points to make on filmmaking before we wrap this up?
I don't have a ton on filmmaking. I guess the only thing would be Blacktail. If there was anything else that you wanted to touch on Blacktail in terms of opportunity or any other stories about Blacktail, there's also the Arizona hunt that I'm somewhat familiar with now, and those are OTC hunts. If there's just anything else that you'd want to touch on, or if you feel like I touched on it already, then that's cool too.
No, I think we got all that. How did that Arizona hunt go for you? I think that was the only hunt we didn't get into too deep.
Dude, I love Arizona. Yeah. Like I said earlier before we started, I could live down there. The weather's nice. It's beautiful. So how it went for me is that I bounce around. I always do. I covered maybe 7 or 8 units in a period of 5 or 6 days. There was one unit that I had some luck in seeing some bucks in it, but I just wasn't seeing the mature buck that I wanted. And then I bounced further south and a unit that I actually harvested a buck in 2021. In 2021, I got my first Arizona OTC buck, and it was a really wide muley. He's like 24 inside and heavy mass all the way out. Just a heavy fork. And so I was a little nervous to go down south because, see, Arizona changed up its over-the-counter, and they went to an online sale December 1st. They didn't tell anybody about the reduction until 2 weeks prior through an email that I didn't read because I was blacktail hunting. And they said they were going to limit, but they didn't say how much. And so that sold out in like 4 or 5 days. And so when somebody messaged me saying, hey, you know, did you get your tag? I called the game, Fish and Game, immediately. And it was like day 5. It was like December 5th. They're like, we're sold out. I'm like, what? I can't do anything? No, you can't. So it was December 5th. And so I changed my plans. I was going to be down there January 1st. So I flipped plane tickets and everything. And I go down on December 18th, I believe. And so I gave myself a little bit of a window there to hunt before my wife and kids would come down on the holiday. And I was awesome to be able to spend the holiday with them down in Arizona, beautiful state. And I got it done in that southern unit. I was nervous about going down south early because it was December, way before the rut. But I turned up a buck by himself. I stalked in on it, crawled in to 30 yards, and I made a decent shot. Actually, I've never done this before, and I don't explain it very well in the film I have, but I had my release that morning and hiking in the dark, I put on my release, and I've got a buckle style, and I didn't hit the tightest buckle hole, and that's where I shoot my release. So when I drew back on my buck, my anchor was off, and I heat of the moment. I've never had that happen. You don't practice that way. So all I felt was something was wrong when looking through my peep sight, and I had to adjust a little bit to see through. And that should have been the first indicator, maybe just to let up, but I had no idea. So I touched off and I ended up hitting a little forward and a little high. And so it turned into a follow-up shot and a follow-up shot. And eventually I did get that buck and recovered it. And it meant a lot to really grind after it. In Arizona this year too, because it had rained so hard, the grass was really tall. I mean, I was grid searching. I didn't have much to go off of for blood trail at first until I turned them up again. And so I was grid searching, you know, waist high grass for like hours all night, like not all night, for a couple hours into the dark, and was like, man, this is brutal. All I can say is that if he made it through this grassy field, he went into a next little basin. I'll turn him up tomorrow. And so I did. I turned him up the next day and got on him, got that buck. And he is just an ancient old deer, worn hair on his nose, missing a couple teeth, beautiful buck, old, heavy 3x3 frame, not a big scoring buck. But again, those old bucks are my dream buck. And so that's, that was the recap on Arizona. Hopefully I get a 2024 tag. I missed out on getting my 2023 tag, and that's all I can do for now.
Yeah. I think a lot of guys missed out on getting tags because, like you said, they didn't really announce it very well that
what they were doing with the non-resident tag system. So
they sent a letter. They sent a letter that I got, and I've read it multiple times, and it just said they were planning to reduce opportunity, and tags will become available for sale. And I think they said early December or around December 1st. It said December 1st. So it told us when the tags were for sale, but it didn't say necessarily that it was only online, and it didn't say that it was going to be 10% of the resident quota or tag sales. So those, that would have been very helpful to know, and that it would sell out, because it's never sold out in history, right? Like, no. I went down and got a 2022 tag after 2023 was sold out. Like, what? Yeah. Bizarre.
Yeah. Well, it used to be unlimited. Like, there was no quota or anything on how many non-resident tags they could sell, and this was the first year they did it, and it was right around 2,500 or 3,000 tags, something like that.
8,980.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, those sold out in I think 4.5 days.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it sold out quick. Like I said, not people knew about it, so I would guess next year when they're this year when they go on sale, they're gonna sell out probably within 24 hours. I would guess.
I have a bad prediction, and that's the website crashes, and that people are super upset and angry, and that they don't get their tags, and it sells out in like a couple hours.
Yeah, it had problems. So I just moved to Arizona at the end of last year, so I was still a non-resident. So I, on the day they went on sale, I woke up at midnight and made sure I bought my tag, but it took a few attempts to get the website to load and get everything to go through. So
I believe it. Yep.
Yeah.
Now imagine that everybody was given a fair warning. Like, it's going to be a complete nightmare. I don't know what they're doing. I hope they're doing something. I hope that they plan to revise that process. And it's other great. I mean, Idaho has gone through all of this, and it was a complete nightmare this year. So I just hope they thought about it. There's so many ways to do this. They can assign a random number, so everybody in advance can apply for a random number. Say that random number corresponds to then them announcing what order you're in that you get to sign in. And your sign-in slot will be this hour on this day. And so everybody that was given that random number, their access code, they sign into the website, and that allows, you know, say 5,000 people to sign in at one time and to get their tag. And that also means that you may not get your tag, because you were assigned a random number. So that's the piece, is that it's fair. Because what's not fair is when websites crash, or when somebody did everything right, just like someone else, but they didn't get the tag. So stuff like that. Like, there's so many ways to do it. I just hope they do it in a fair way that doesn't, you know, make people all upset, because that's the goal, is not to get mad at each other, or especially the agencies. Like, we want to partner with the agencies. We want to preserve and conserve hunting opportunity. So I'm all about, you know, changing systems in order to be, to better manage game. I'm all on board with it. I just want it to be a fair opportunity and for them to really think it through. So hopefully they've done that. I have my fingers crossed.
Hopefully. We'll see what happens. I'll be interested to see what changes they make. I mean, what they're doing in Arizona. So if a unit fills its quota for the amount of deer killed 2 years in a row, that unit will then become a draw unit.
I've heard that.
So we saw, I mean, a ton of units, with the exception of most of like your Southern Arizona units, get full. So if I had to guess, within 5 years or so, you'll probably see the Arizona over-the-counter deer tag go away for that reason. All those units fill their quotas for multiple years in a row.
Right.
Now,
no, I think I did hear that, see that. Especially those northern units. All those northern units shut down fast.
For sure. But that being said, all those units, I think you're still going to have really good opportunity to get a tag even for non-residents. Because they were already over the counter, I think you're going to see those units become like a 0 to 1 point draw unit. I mean, there's rifle tags in Arizona. I drew one as a non-resident last year with 0 points for coos deer. So it can be done. I think you'll still have that opportunity.
Yeah.
It just won't be a true over the counter. You're going to have to pick exactly which unit you want to go to.
Yeah. So, yeah. How does the first and second pass work? Like,
So Arizona, so they consider your first. So I think you have five choices in Arizona for your tag or for what hunt you want to put in for. Really only your first two count because they'll go through everybody's first and second choices first. And then they go to your previous choices after they've gone through every single applicant's first and second choice. And for pretty much 90% of the hunts, if not more, all of those hunts are gone in the first two, in your first two choices, once they make that first pass through everybody.
Okay.
So the really, I mean, if you look at deer hunts, like the ones that are left over usually aren't very good. They're very, you know, limited opportunity, public, private land issues, things like that. For elk, sometimes you have cow elk hunts left over when you get to that second pass. Antelope, you really won't ever see any tags when you get to that second pass, but that's how that works in Arizona. So if you're especially as a non-resident, really only your first two choices count unless you maybe want some kind of like cow elk hunt.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. And then in terms of antelope too, it's like there's nothing that's less than like 16 or 17 points.
Oh, required. No. No, I mean, even as an Arizona resident, you're going to play the long game waiting for an Arizona antelope tag.
Yeah, and the other question that comes is, will you ever hit it with point creep and all of that? So, like antelope seems to be a dying, you know, tag.
Yeah, I mean, the way Arizona's draw system works is, I mean, even if you have 0 points, there is still a chance because everybody gets randomly assigned a spot in that line. So you don't see like your typical issues with point creep as much in Utah. There's still some of it, but even at, like, I know a guy that last hunting season, 0 points drew a bighorn sheep tag here in Arizona. Like, you have that random chance because, like I said, even if you only got one name in there, yours could randomly get thrown on top of the pile. So,
and it's like that for deer and elk as well, not just the, yep, like the big species.
Yep, it's like that for all of them.
Oh,
so
okay, I Arizona, thought it was like reference point based.
Yep. So Arizona, I mean, if you're paying the money for the license and putting in for all the other species, you might as well put in for every species that Arizona offers just because there is that random chance. And your application fee isn't too much. It's like 10, 20 bucks, something like that. So,
yeah. And I typically already have a license because I'll do the OTC hunt. So I always throw in for everything.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there's always a chance. So, and I mean, even as a non-resident, I mean, eventually, yeah, I would say, unless you're waiting for like the top hunt in any given species, you'll draw a tag. Like, you'll draw an archery elk tag in the rut if you want to wait long enough. You'll draw probably like an archery antelope tag. You know, you'll get a good mule deer tag. I mean, so there's opportunity out there for non-residents in Arizona for sure.
Yeah, no, that's neat. And then, you know, near where you live, I do like that. That middle plateau region seems like that's where the deer numbers start to pick up. And it's just a type of terrain that I don't particularly love with like a sparse juniper tree.
Yeah.
And some of the lowlands, and you get up higher and maybe there's pockets of ponderosa pine. But it's like if you didn't catch the deer moving in between, when they bed down, they're invisible more or less. So
yeah. It
comes down to a lot of a glassing game. And it's pretty difficult to like still hunt or be active all day because you could just ruin the opportunity because you blow them out. They're so smart. Those deer are so switched on, those muleys down there. And so from a statewide perspective, I really do like the more arid units that are a little bit more open because a deer can get up at any point in the day. And if you're glassing, you're probably going to turn it up.
Yep.
And I just like that opportunity. If it stood up, you'll see it. It's not because there's 30 million juniper trees in the way. So that's what makes it tough about that kind of that belt. It's like the belt around Arizona, that middle belt. Yeah, it's kind of tricky in that area. So you're probably learning the state. How you've been there just over a year?
Yeah, I moved here just before, well, not just over a year, just before Thanksgiving. I moved here of last year. But I hunted Arizona January of last year as well. So I've hunted it a little bit. I've done some javelina hunting way down south by the border a little bit. So I've been in Arizona a little bit, but yeah, I'm definitely still learning it. But I mean, I've heard a lot of guys like on different podcasts says that, you know, kill a ton of deer. They say like, if you can kill a deer in the Arizona desert, you can pretty much kill a mule deer anywhere. So
interesting. But. Well, that's good to hear. I think I've been, so in my two trips in Arizona, it took me, I think, about the same amount of time, both trips. It was on like day six that I got a buck. And I had also covered, since the 2 years I've done it, 2021 and 2020, I believe I've been in over 20 units. I've probably been in like 25 different units. Some days I'd be a morning and an evening in different units, and I would bounce around. There's one time where I did 3 units in a day. So it was like, I just wanted to get a feel for what that terrain looked like. And if I didn't like it, I would leave.
Yep.
Until I found a place that I liked it and the deer numbers matched, and I could see myself spending that night and the next morning there. And that's where I stuck it out and ended up getting bucks pretty much in the same small mountain range. So yeah, I love that state. It's beautiful and it's got opportunity. And that state, that OTC tag was nearly statewide. Now with the quotas, of course, it did pare it down quickly. December, I was watching them kind of drop like flies. And then the quota system is not reset until August. So that January, even though you have a new tag, you know, it's the 2024 or that I will have next, or a lot of people now with the 2023 tag. So January was basically hunting what was left open.
Yep.
And then August rolls around, everything opens back up with a fresh new quota. So that was interesting to me, that the quota did not follow the calendar year tag.
I agree. I'd like to see them. I think the way the quota timeline works, and I know this is going to be a controversial topic here, but I do kind of agree with the fact that as you get into that rut, the hunts are limited because, I mean, deer are easier to kill in the rut.
Oh, absolutely.
And if we're not out there pressuring them in the rut, one, they have the opportunity to go and rut freely without any pressure, and we're not killing as many deer, and hopefully that'll bring the population back up. And I get it's a ton of fun to go hunt in the rut. That's when everybody wants to come to Arizona and hunt, is that late December through January. But I think it's better for the deer this way.
I do agree. I do agree. And I also know that, you know, you're shooting more mature bucks during the rut, where during August, you're going to shoot the first buck that comes by, which might be less mature. So a less mature buck can't breed as many does. And there's a lot of does. Every time I've ever been to Arizona, I've counted, I saw 20 does today and one buck, you know? And that's like the theme for me, is I'll turn up all these does and it's the rut. I'm like, where? And so I think that Arizona might be hurting in that older age class. So I do think it's a good change. And I do think keeping those older bucks around for the rut is super important to have fawn recruitment and getting all the does bred. Cause we're not sure that all the does are even getting bred. There has to be enough mature bucks to breed all those does. I'm not a biologist. I don't know how many does a buck can breed, but there was a number that my dad used to kick around when we were talking about Oregon numbers. And I know this is wrong, but I want to throw out a number like 30. So it's like a mature buck can only breed, say, like 30 does in that year. And in Arizona, I'm seeing herds of 25. So, you know, you got to have enough mature bucks to breed all those does. The little guys aren't really going to get it done. So I do think it's a good change.
Yeah. I will say the one thing with the quota, though, that I've seen is it almost seems like guys are more willing to shoot a smaller deer, because if they're looking at those dates, they're like, oh man, there's only two deer left in this unit. I got to get something because I don't want to go hunt anywhere else. They'll go out there and just shoot a spike or a little forky or something like that, which I'm all for shooting whatever makes you happy. I mean, I haven't killed a deer yet. I mean, if a spike or a fork walks out at 25 yards, he's probably going to take an arrow. But I mean, I do think that's something that has affected people's mindset a little bit, has made them a little bit more willing to shoot small deer, because they know they don't have 3 whole months to hunt. They might only have 2 weeks before that unit closes down
And those deer in Arizona, they're not really big bodied. No. So if the argument is that, oh, I'm just a meat eater, well, I mean, yeah, but that's like, we're talking like 35 pounds, maybe finished weight. I mean, maybe more. I don't feel dress a ton of mule deer. I'm mostly a blacktail guy, but a small forky or spike, like, you're not going to get a ton of meat off that animal.
No.
And it is pressuring people. They're not going to be as selective. They're going to take what they can get. And it's kind of a waste a little bit in terms of what the harvest could be. You know, you want to get the most meat that you can for the punch in the tag. So it's a tough one. Game management's so tough. I envy those that can do a good job at it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there's all the different challenges that all the agency officials have to go through. There's a lot of pressure, everything from conservationists and hunters to the other opposing side, even from the commission level, whoever the board of commissioners or the whoever manages game at the highest level, there's pressures there too. So definitely do, you know, I don't envy, I mean, that position, and I'm glad they're doing it. And I hope that they continue to make the best decisions they can, and that they get stakeholder buy-in and input. That's very important. That is not, you know, a closed door on input. But yeah, it's very, very tough job to hold with what they're facing today for challenges. Definitely. Yeah.
Definitely. Cool, man. Well, I don't want to keep you on here too much longer. I know you got kids that you got to get to bed, but before I let you go, one question that I try to ask every guest is for a book recommendation. So I don't know if there's a book that you got for us that you might want to recommend to people.
It's not going to be hunting related. I'm sorry to say that.
That is fine with me. I'm all for any type of book out there.
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite books is Born to Run. I was a runner. It's kind of a classic, almost cliche to say this, you know, book, but is it Scott McDowell? I'm blanking on the name. I want to say Scott McDowell wrote that book, and he talks a lot about, I like the book because it tells a lot of stories, short stories. It's not from cover to cover. It's not necessarily one story. It's kind of his journey. It's his journey as a writer and wanting to become a runner. But why does my foot hurt? That was like the initial catch to the whole book. Mm-hmm. It goes through, it talks about the history of running, the mechanics of running, why his foot hurt, talks about these crazy Tarahumara men from Mexico who have these insane parties and get out and run for a couple days at a time. It's just a wild, crazy story. And then bringing these tribal men to then like legitimate races in the States. Okay. The Leadville, it's the in Leadville, Colorado.
Yeah,
exactly. And then these men run the race. Have you read this book?
I know. I've heard of it, but I haven't read it.
Yeah, highly recommend you read it. Great book. And then it's got my favorite story of all time. So I'll say it real quick since I said that. Okay. So Scott, this guy, Scott, and I don't know how to say his last name. It's spelt like Jurek. So this guy, Scott Jurek, we'll say that. He is one of the earliest ultramarathoners that was really good. And he was a male. Since then, a lot of females have dominated the ultra scene. So this guy, he was doing the Badwater ultramarathon. And so you're going mm-hmm. through the desert. And it's over 100 miles, and he's running the race, and there's a competitor that's out in front of him. And I think he'd already had been gapped by over like 10 or 20 miles or something like that. And he's breaking down, he's exhausted, and he collapses. So he hits the side of the road, and he's laying in his own, like, I think it says spittle, like, so he's spitting up, you know, like dry heaving. And his teammates, which is his, like his, some family members and like a coach, were sitting there like watching him from the roadside. I think you could follow him in a vehicle. So they're watching him, and they know there's really nothing they could do, because the voice in Scott's head was much more powerful than anything that they could say.
Yeah.
So it's like, I always want to leave people with something to really chew on and think about. I'm always like a message driven person. So the voice in your head is so very important to what you accomplish and achieve in this lifetime. And the time that you have, which is very short, it's a gift. The time that you have, what you do with it, that voice in your head drives that ship, right? It's going to take you where you need to go. And if you listen to that voice, and if it's a positive message, which means that you're putting positive messages in your head, you're going to accomplish pretty much any goal you set out to do. There's really no limit to what the human body can achieve. We see that through so many great athletes. Everything from, you know, Cameron Haynes, Goggins, just some phenomenal athletes out there in the industry that also kind of hunting related. So back to that race. Scott's laying on the ground. His team, they know that what Scott's telling himself is more powerful than anything they can say. And so he gets up and he shatters the record and he beats his competition. Like, it's such a huge turn of events to go from laying on the ground, basically collapsed and done, to then winning the race and shattering the previous record. So it's just that you can do so much as long as you have a competitive or a mental drive that you listen to. And that voice in your head is what's leading you to do well. So that's my favorite book. That was a long story. But I hope others read it. You don't have to be a runner to appreciate the stories that are in that book. It's some really good ones. And I'm a runner. And obviously I march to the beat of that drum. I'm a guy that, you know, I just am constantly setting goals for myself internally. And I tell myself that, I remind myself that. And, you know, if you want to accomplish something, the only way to do it is just really to keep after it. And what you tell yourself matters. So,
yeah. I'll have to check it out, because I've recently found my love for running again. I used to run a ton when I was all that stuff. And then, you know, since then, you know, over the last couple months, and about every day of the week. So I've found my love for running again. So.
If you ever want to chat running, hit me up anytime. Dude, I did it in college, man. Like, I know everything. I know a lot about running. So feel free to hit.
Definitely. Cool, man. Well, Nathan, thanks for coming on, man. I had a great time. Before we let you go, let people know how they can find you, how they can find your films and all that good stuff.
On Instagram, my Instagram is at NathanForYou. I have a YouTube channel. It's just my name, Nathan Endicott. You can also find it by Endicott Films. You can Google endicottfilms.com. That is a small landing page, which has both the links to the Instagram and to my YouTube channel. So that's kind of the best way to get in touch with me. I'm always open to taking a DM. If someone hits me up, I'm going to respond. I'm going to do my best to try to help you out. I don't know everything, but I always do try to tell you what I do know.
Awesome, man. And then if people want to go to the Full Draw film tour and see your film, how can they do that?
Yeah. So the Full Draw just updated their website. I shared it to my story last night. So if you were to go to fulldrawfilmtour.com, and then up in the right-hand corner at the menu symbol, hit the menu symbol, hit tour, and then boom, it generates a list of all the locations. I don't know the number, but it looks like there's at least 50 locations across the United States, from East Coast to West Coast. Most of them are on the West Coast. I saw Arizona had a location. Where was it? It might even be Prescott.
Is it in Prescott? They have one in Tucson, Chandler, and Flagstaff.
Flagstaff, okay. Chandler, okay.
And Flagstaff is, I'm trying to go to it, but it seems like that's the only one that they don't have tickets on sale for yet.
Okay.
Yeah, I keep clicking the link for Flagstaff, and it just says these tickets are not available for sale yet. So,
got it. Okay.
The other two in Arizona I could buy tickets for.
Maybe they're still trying to drill down the details on where or what, or what time and date.
For sure.
So, yeah, that's how you could get a ticket. I know that every venue has a limit. This year, I watched the trailers and I'm actually really impressed. I really feel that there's a lot of good films this year. It hasn't always been that way. While there usually are a couple of really good films, but I do feel like this year across the board, everybody really delivered, I think, a good film. Now, again, that's judging it all in the trailer. Yep. But this year is a really cool film tour. I'm excited. I'm so blessed that we get to be a part of it. And then my dad's hunt. My dad is so vulnerable in his hunt. I'm so proud of him. And he let me share this film. I did all the editing myself. I was the cameraman. So I just hope so much that people are able to receive what he put out there. It's like, I feel like you are open to being judged when you open yourself up, you know, at that level, at that platform level. And my dad did such a good job. And so I am excited. I left a lot of raw footage, basically raw being just raw emotion in there. And I mean, when your life goal dream is to eventually, maybe, probably not, get a sheep tag and you draw it and you get a sheep, and then to watch that emotion unfold, it's pretty neat. So definitely someday it'll be on my YouTube, but I highly recommend people go into the Full Draw, support that cause, and get yourself a ticket and just go to their website.
Awesome, man. Well, I look forward to seeing it. And then, Nathan, thanks again for coming on, and I will talk to you soon, buddy.
Thanks, Caleb.
No problem. Bye.
All right, guys. I hope you guys enjoyed that podcast with Nathan Endicott. I had a great time talking with him. Like I said, it's a little bit longer podcast than we usually do on these episodes, but I think it was pretty entertaining the whole way through. So I hope you guys got some insight out of it into the filmmaking stuff. There's some good life lessons you can learn in that podcast as well. But before I let you guys go, make sure you guys follow the podcast on Instagram. It's barely_backcountry_podcast. And then my personal is c.dillashaw. Again, make sure you guys give the podcast a like, a follow, a share, all those good things. They all help out a ton. I appreciate you guys listening. I'll see you guys on the next one.